Okay, so today it's a pleasure to introduce Stephanie Coleman, who is Associate Professor at the School of Forest Resources and Conservation at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And she did her Master's and PhD at the University of Washington, and did the postdocs in the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama, and with Steve Pakala in Princeton, and since then has been at Florida. And she's also currently on sabbatical at IDIF in Leipzig in Germany, and left over from there to give this seminar. So welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm under the lights.
Okay. It's a lot of pictures in this presentation. So I'm going to tell you today about a project I've been working on for several years with collaborators, including with Sammy in this room, where we're using UAVs or drones to look at forest phenology at the individual tree and species level. There we go. And so first I'm going to talk a little bit about why we would be interested in quantifying individual species level phenology, how we're trying to do that, and then some preliminary ecological results that we've gotten from our predicted phenology for individual trees and species. And mentioned this is a product of work of a lot of people, including Jonathan Dandois and Milton Garcia, who are the drone gurus. They fly the machines. Sammy and John have done a lot of the analysis, and then Helena Mueller-Landau and Jeremy Lichtstein, we've supervised this project. So why would we care about phenology? Well, shifting phenology in response to climate change has been sort of a sentinel of the fact that there is impacts of climate change through time, and this is one of the stronger pieces of evidence in the IPCC, and part of why we know this is happening on landscape levels is through satellite remote sensing. So we've been able to detect earlier leaf out in temperate forests, as well as increase longer dates of leaf out. So this is strong evidence that the warming climate is impacting phenology in temperate areas. The shifting phenology has cascades through the whole ecosystem, including impacts on the timing of plant-animal interactions, as well as impact on ecosystem processes, such as carbon uptake and water cycling. Unfortunately, almost all of what we know about plant phenology, and especially in response to climate change, is in temperate and boreal ecosystems. So this is a map from a paper showing plant studies in response to climate change, and you notice that almost all of those dots are in the northern hemisphere. Very little information in tropical areas. So what? Why do we care about that? I don't have to convince most of you that tropical forests are important for many reasons, including their disproportionate contribution to the global carbon cycle. And as I mentioned, the shifting phenology can have impacts on plant-animal interactions. Tropical forests have some of the most intricate and multi-trophic interactions between plants and animals. Yet we know very little about how climate change may shift phenology, in particular how that might cascade through the whole ecosystem. So why is that? Why don't we know much about phenology? I would argue one of the reasons is because phenology is so much more complex in tropical forests than temperate and boreal ecosystems. So in places like England, species are mostly either evergreen or they're deciduous in the winter. In tropical areas, there are many different patterns of phenology, and most of those we think are, or at least they apparently are, coinciding with the dry season. But there's not just deciduous and evergreen species, as is sometimes classified. There are partially deciduous species. There are species that have two periods where they lose leaves. There are species that lose leaves one year and don't lose leaves the other year. And these are all things that have been observed from the ground but are very hard to quantify because of the diversity of patterns, the lack of synchrony among individuals of the same species, as well as the difficulty in getting large sample sizes because of the high diversity. So Instead of having a lot of quantitative data on individual species, a lot of times we classify species mostly based on expert opinion into different phenological functional types or phenoclasses. And so I've listed some of those here. More and more, some of these are being used in models of forest dynamics. For example, these two, this is work by Ralph Borchert, who is one of the earliest researchers that have described plant phenology in the tropics. But those have now been, because of their relationship to whole life history traits, we can link those to different processes and models. So we know plant phenology is intricately related to carbon cycling in individual species as well as water balance. And so there are attempts to model this by different functional types. Getting field data, quantitative field data, I mentioned, is very difficult. There are some long-term data sets that are field-based, but most, if not all, of these have limitations. For example, on Barro Colorado Island, which is where the work I did was done, there's a 32-year litterfall record, which is amazing. But litterfall only gives us one set of the picture of phenology. So in the tropics, individual species and trees can simultaneously drop leaves and flush new leaves. And litterfall doesn't give us any information on when new leaves emerge, and also about the changes in leaf density. And these litter traps cannot give you information on individual trees as well. There are some long-term data sets where people go out in the field with binoculars and estimate leaf cover, which in and of itself is challenging because you're looking through a multi-layer canopy and trying to estimate what's happening at the top of the tree. And because of that, you can only get a few individuals per species. So we now have new tools to look at phenology that I think are going to help us understand species, individual, and stand level phenology better. And a lot of these are remote sensing tools, including satellite data that has helped us really nail down some of these shifts in temperate and boreal systems, but many other types of remote sensing at smaller spatial scales where we have the potential to capture what's happening at individual tree levels. So I'm going to be talking about UAVs, but I think using this information together is the best approach to really understanding, describing phenology, understanding its drivers, as well as its consequences for whole ecosystems. So why not just use satellite images in the tropics? This is one main reason. This is a series of Landsat images for the study site I'll be talking about. So there are many problems when you want to look at a high time frequency process such as phenology in the tropics, including cloud cover, haze, changes in solar angle, sensor artifacts. And it makes it difficult to see these subtle changes in phenology because we're not talking about large changes as we see in temperate forests with whole stands losing their leaves. These are individual trees popping in and out, losing their leaves. So there have been insights into phenology from satellite images, but much controversy surrounding that, including this long-standing debate about if forests in the Amazon green up during the dry season. So initial analysis said they are greening up. Others said they don't green up. Come back with other pieces of evidence that they do green up. And I think this debate will continue, at least from a satellite perspective, because of you can't observe visually the actual changes, and the artifacts are difficult to remove those in order to see this subtle pattern. But we have those other tools now that are helping resolve this issue, including cameras mounted on towers. So this is a study in a few sites in the Amazon that was able to visually detect that these, some of the tree species, the majority of them, were leafing up in the dry season. Some problems with that is that there's limited spatial coverage, so this was 267 tree crowns to define the phenology of the whole Amazon, and it's very difficult to identify the species. So you can do stand level analysis, but not necessarily look at changes, how different species are changing phenologically so that we can understand what the drivers are. A recent new piece of information that is really exciting is terrestrial LIDAR. So this is looking at seasonal changes in the distribution of leaf profiles that also gives some evidence that there is increasing leaf density at the top of the canopy during the dry season. But again, there's limitations in spatial coverage, as well as looking at individual trees and species. So this is where I think UAVs can really add significant information to our understanding of tropical tree phenology, because you can fly it underneath the clouds, so it's not restricted by cloud cover. It can be deployed flexibly. It's cheap now. When we first started this and we were crashing our UAVs every few weeks, it was not cheap, but now the technology is reliable. It covers large areas, and we can see individual trees and link that to field data so that we have species level information. So, what questions can we answer from these UAV images? So, starting out with an image like this that we took from the UAV, if we can delineate the individual crowns, we can describe the phenology of tens to hundreds of thousands of individual trees. And then look at things like what is the role of microenvironment or neighborhood in impacting phenology over the landscape. If then we can link these to information on species, either from field data or from things like hyperspectral data that can be used to classify species, then we can go another level. We can look at how phenology varies within species and among species over large areas, and use that to help us understand how phenology is related to overall species life history traits. Then at the stand level, we can look at how phenology impacts other ecosystem patterns, such as carbon flux, and through a long-term set of data, I think we'll be able to look at how leaf phenology shifts with climate changes. So this all depends on the fact that we can get quantitative data from these images on phenology. So our first step was a proof of concept. Is this a viable way to get not just nice images, and they are beautiful. I've spent many, many, many hours looking at these images, and they're fascinating. There are so many little interesting stories just looking at these series of images. But what we need is quantitative data. And so we developed the process of collecting the data, delineating tree crowns, associating those images, the tree crowns and images, to field data. And in there, we need automated ways to do this, because it's too time-consuming to do this over a large spatial scale, especially if we want to do this for multiple years to look at impacts of climate change. I'll mention briefly that this is sort of embedded in a larger sort of my research interests, looking at landscape patterns of species, traits, and demographic rates. And one of the tools for doing landscape studies like this is using remote sensing. So using UAV and also other platforms such as hyperspectral data to look at phenological traits, but also species, leaf chemical traits. And one of my interests is in looking at seeing if we can understand demographic rates, growth and mortality from remote sensing data. But here I'm just going to talk about the phenology work, which was done on Barro Colorado Island in Panama, which has semi-deciduous forests, so it has species that are broadly classified as evergreen and deciduous and everywhere in between. So it's a good place to look at how different phenological patterns change spatially and through time and why they coexist. Also another reason for using BCI is there's a, as many of you know, there's a tremendous amount of field data. And so if we can take the images and link them to this field data, we can unlock a lot of the ecological information from those images and then scale that up to larger areas. And I'll show you how we've done this here. And we started doing the UAV flights back in 2014. Up in the top is Jonathan Dandois, who at that time made his own UAVs, and they crashed all the time, and we'd have to go retrieve them from the forest, the top of the canopy. But now it's very routine to do these images. We've also added some hyperspectral flights, which I'm excited to see what that information will give us. Let's skip this first flight where we're scaring the howler monkeys with the drones. So here's one of the images that are very pleasing to look at. You can see the different phenological patterns. This tree is mostly deciduous. This one's got about 50% tree cover, so you can visually see the phenological differences among these tree crowns. But our biggest challenge is to go from these pre-pictures to quantitative data. So we want to get things like species growth mortality and gap production through time. Or if we can identify species, maybe what species distributions are from images, UAV images. And for this talk, I'll be talking about getting quantitative data on phenology. So how we get to species level phenology in this context is that we link these images, like the one in the lower right-hand corner, to the mapped stem forest inventory. So we take the images, we hand delineated through visual observation each of the crowns that we could visually detect. Then we took the image on a field tablet and connected each tree crown to a stem. So visually determined this crown is this tag tree stem. And once we have that, for each tree, we know its tag number, its species, and its DBH history for the last 30 years. And we're able to do that for about 2,000 tree crowns. So there's a lot of people doing that. A student of mine has written up a methods paper so that other people can do it if they want. I'll mention that field, one of the biggest comments I get from people when I show this, they say, well, you have to hand delineate everything. You can't do that for huge areas of the tropics. There's been a lot of work on how to do this automatically. It works fairly well in some ecosystems, including conifer forests, which have a nice three-dimensional shape, or open forests. In closed canopy forests, the results are not as promising, but I think they're improving. So this is one crowd delineation that was done from automated method. And you can see the problems with that. There's some, this one is more or less correctly identified, but some of the one tree is separated into three different trees, and in this case, three trees are included as one. I think these algorithms will develop to the point where they're much better at auto-delineation, but at this point, we're sticking with the hand delineation that has been field verified. So the rest of the results will be showing this, the results using our field verified hand delineations. So what we get, because we took a year's worth of data, 34 dates, and for each tree crown now, we can look at what that tree was doing over the year. So I'll just show you a few examples of what these individual trees look like. This is Dipteryx panamensis, which started out in October, fully leaved. Starting in about May, you can see it's starting to lose leaves. By the end of July, it's fully leafless. In this few-week time span, it's fully regenerated new leaves. And you can see that it's flowering at this time period. So you can visually see and estimate what's happening in these images. Here is another species, Tabebuia rosea, that flowers before it drops its leaves. Here's one that's more partially deciduous, so it's not fully losing all of the leaves in the upper canopy ever. And another example. So you can see the richness of different phenological patterns just from these four examples. So we have these nice images, we can see things are happening. How do we get to quantitative data? Well, there's been work on this, especially from using those Tower Mountain phenocams. So we only have three channels. We have red, green, and blue. And so a lot of the work in temperate forests have been successfully using the green channel. So you can see green going up and down as leaves are gained or lost. We've tried using this, and other people have, in other tropical forests without any success. So here's an example of the same green channel pattern in BCI. Okay. It's kind of low, kind of brown, not as green in the dry season. But there's lots of noise, and there's also two other time periods where it has low green. So this method was not working. So instead we used machine learning algorithms to see if that would give better estimates of leaf cover through time. So, and why we can use this, and this I think will be more and more widely used to translate UAV images into ecological information, is because you can visually see what's happening. So it's similar to those people who go out in the field with binoculars and estimate the leaf cover, except we're looking down on the images. And we can do things like have multiple observers look at the same images. And so this is a time series where we've visually estimated the leaf and branch cover through time. And then we can use machine learning algorithms that will take different features of the images, including the overall color, so the greenness, redness, and blueness, but also the texture. So you can see when this crown loses leaves, it's much more patchy in the color. And you can quantify that and use it in the machine learning algorithms. So we created a set of visual estimates that was then combined with these features of individual tree crowns using a machine learning algorithm to develop an algorithm and test that on a separate held out set of data where we also did visual estimates. If we think that's working well, then we can apply it to all the 2,000 tree crowns that we have. So the question is, how well does this work? And we had a testing and training data set of 8 species that had different phenological patterns to see if this approach worked. So I'll go through how well this worked at different spatial scales. These are the individual frames where it's got a high R squared between the observation, visual observations, and the predicted observations of leaf cover. But what we really want to do is not just get leaf cover of individual tree frames, tree frames. We want to look at how well can this describe the phenology of the whole time series for each crown. And so this is some examples of individual tree crowns. The white is observations we visually estimated. The black dots are the predictions. So you can see it's predicting that time series for individual tree crowns. Then we can aggregate that to the species level. And again, we are successfully reproducing the species patterns through time. And this is at the whole stand level, so aggregating all those tree crowns together. And we do a much better job than using the standard method in this field, which is using the green channel. So we felt this was successful. I want to briefly say how we had different observers, including me and Sammy, were the test people who did the extra observations. And so you can see up here is how the different observers' leaf cover compared to each other. So it's pretty good, but it's not perfect. We had different estimates, visual estimates, of those individual tree frames. But if we train the algorithm using different observers and see how those predictions compare, we get much tighter predictions. And so the algorithm is quite insensitive to these differences among observers. And our observations, we didn't train with each other. So this is kind of the worst case scenario where you take anyone off the street like Sammy and have them do visual estimates. But it still works well in the algorithm. And so you can already start seeing some of the information we can get about individual species. So this is the 8 test species we use. The solid line is the species mean, and then the individual dotted lines are what the individual trees were doing within that species. So some species, like Xanthoxylum, have high synchrony among the individuals, whereas other species, such as Pavaguia guaicon, had a tremendous amount of diversity in the timing and the amplitude of leaf cover change through time. So we felt like the proof of concept was successful. We're able to accurately predict leaf cover and phenology patterns, and that then we could apply that then to the all 2,000 tree crowns. And so I'll show some preliminary results about what ecological information we get from all 2,000 of those tree crowns, including levels of inter and intraspecific phenology, and how well they match these expert classifications of plant phenological plant functional types I showed you earlier, how they relate to plant traits, the effect of lianas on phenology, observed phenology, how that might scale up to satellite information, and finally, a little bit of information about how the phenology changes between normal and El Niño years. So, while we have those nice, we feel confident in the prediction of the individual tree and species phenology, that's still not a number. It's a curve. And so we're developing different metrics from that curve. So this is one species where the closed circles are the predictions of its phenology through time. So we can estimate when leaf drop is happening, leaf flush, the length of the period this tree is deciduous, at least partially deciduous, what the peak deciduousness is. And in the case of this species, it's got a second period of deciduousness that we would need to quantify. We can also measure the overall deciduousness of individual crowns. And so we can take the area under the curve of the deciduousness or branch or leaf cover of these individual trees, and then divide that from the number of observations, or in this case, we interpolated it for the whole year. So we can get an average deciduousness for each tree crown. So I'll show you some of the results of some of these metrics. We haven't worked out all the metrics yet, including getting the leaf drop and leaf flush date automatically is pretty challenging. But this is community level results. So each one of these dots is a species. The length of the bar, and this the y-axis is the average deciduousness. So if you averaged how much each day the tree had leaf cover, this is what its average would be through the whole year. The bars are the 95% of the data, and the colors are the plant functional types or phenoclasses that have been used on BCI in several analyses. So we're interested to see, like, how well do these metrics match what we've been using as measures of phenology. And so I've highlighted two species that have the exact same average leaf cover during the year, but very vastly different variation among trees. Also of note is that there's not, different groups of average deciduousness. It varies continuously through amongst all these species. So we don't see evidence necessarily of very naturally occurring functional types, at least from this one piece of information. This next slide, just wanted to briefly show these were the species we used for training. So some of the more deciduous species. And again, highlighting how these different functional types that we've been using span very large ranges of the deciduousness spectrum. So while they're overall in the right order, we would expect with obligate deciduous species that lose their leaves at the same time every year, facultative deciduous that lose their leaves sometimes but others not, to evergreen, follow the pattern we expect, but there's a lot of overlap. This is another metric, which is just the maximum deciduous. So what is the maximum deciduousness each crown achieves during the year? So the variation among species is more consistent. There's also a little more separation between deciduous and evergreen species, and that may be because when we're out in the field, what we associate with the species is what it looks like at its most deciduous time, versus integrating that over the whole year. And then we can add some of these metrics together and start looking at defining new plant functional types that are driven by quantitative data rather than experts' classification of what a species is doing. We're also interested in what are the strategies of species and how that relates to their phenological patterns. And so this is, I cherry-picked some of the relationships with traits that have the strongest R-squared value, so including higher deciduousness on the x-axis tends to have more leaf nitrogen, more leaf phosphorus, higher specific leaf area, and also taller trees tend to be more deciduous. And so we're planning to expand this as more trait data becomes available from BCI, including more hydraulic traits, because we believe that the phenological strategies of these species will be highly related to some of these hydraulic life history traits. Lianas. So the data I showed before are only for trees that had low liana cover. So each one of these trees we also scored out in the field if they in a 4 or 5 category liana cover system. And so this is one of the images showing the same species with low liana and high liana cover. So there's a lot of thought and evidence that one of the impacts of lianas is that one of the strategies of lianas in dry tropical forests is that they're not as vulnerable to drought, and so they can keep their leaves during the dry season. And so this should show up when we look at the phenological patterns. This is just some very simple analysis I did looking at the mean deciduousness per day, so the percent deciduousness, for these different plant phenotypes at different liana levels. So this is with no lianas, crowns with no lianas, crowns with high lianas. And in fact, as liana cover increases, the apparent deciduousness of that tree crown goes down. And that's probably because the liana leaves are maintained through the dry season or through the period where the host tree is losing its leaves. And so there's going to be some more work on this using drones and some of the, there's a liana removal site near BCI where we can really look at partitioning what the lianas are doing versus the host tree. So this is all work on individual and species level, but to get whole stand and landscape level phenology, UIVs can only get us so far because of they only cover certain amounts of areas, and so we want to connect this to satellite-based information. And so this is some work that John Park did with Jin Wu, trying to get a MODIS signal for Panama. And so a lot of the satellite-based phenology information is composite from multiple years, especially where cloud cover is a problem, like in BCI. So they needed to go do a 10-year time composite, year composite, before they could get a reliable phenological pattern from the satellite data from BCI. And so the blue line is the phenological pattern from a 10-year MODIS series,
And the green is from, oops, did that wrong. The green is the MODIS. The blue is the composite of all those UAV tree crowns that we measured. And so broadly, you see that the pattern is similar. There's a shift, however, between the UAV and the satellite data. We don't know if that's because they're taken at different time periods or if they're actually responding to different things that are happening in the canopy. So the UAV is measuring leaf cover. Some of the satellite-derived products we know can be altered by the quality of the leaf, so if those are bright green versus darker green. So those are some reasons those might be slightly different. So the last slide is a very preliminary figure that Sammy made that looks at two time periods. So our last image, we had images in May of 2015, which was a normal year, or a El Nino year, and in May of 2016, which was a normal year. So we're able to look at the deciduousness of individual tree crowns between those two time periods and look at the variants, how that changed within species and among species. And so these are about eight species and how they shifted between the drought and non-drought time periods. And so you can see most of the species had more deciduousness in the El Nino year, but the intraspecific variation in that response was very different. So some species had a very wide range of variation between those two time periods, whereas others had much more tight responses among individuals between the two time periods. And so we're excited to look at the whole 5-year now time series to start looking at what some of this variation is through time. All right, so our next steps are to do a more complete analysis of some of the things I've shown you, connect with other sources of data on Barro Colorado Island, including there's a phenocam that has much higher time frequency data, so it's every 15 minutes. The litterfall data, there's tree growth data, including some that are sub-annual measurements of tree growth, as well as satellite data. So, but this is all for just one site. So I think it's really important to look at how well this works in other sites and also start looking at some of the variation amongst sites as well. And then ultimately, we want to use this information to both inform models of tree and forest dynamics, including new parameterizations of phenology itself, as well as it can be used as a validation. So many of these models predict what leaf cover and leaf density is through time, and these types of measurements can potentially be used as validation for those. So just to wrap up, so I think this study has really emphasized the high diversity in phenological patterns, even more than what I think we all expected when we started out this study. And sites like BCI and other places with intense data are good sort of laboratories for trying to extract ecological information from drone images that then can be applied to larger areas. And I think UAVs, along with these other types of tools that we're now developing, each one has strengths and weaknesses, but bringing those together can give us a more complete picture of tropical tree phenology and its drivers. So is it light? Is it water? Is it relationships with pollinators or pathogens? As well as the consequences of phenological change. And so I think this increased toolbox will help us catch up with the temperate forest folks in understanding how phenology might change through time and what the impacts of that might be. And I'd be happy to take any questions or hear your ideas as well.